Hello, my name's John Schaefer, and I'm here today with Carl Vine, manager of the M&G Japan Fund. Carl, thanks so much for joining me today.
Glad to be here, thanks.
You've had pretty hefty inflows over the past year, more than $2 billion into your fund. Why has that strategy been so popular, and what do you do that's different?
I guess the popularity point, I suspect, has got a lot to do with global asset allocators looking at Japan and seeing structural reform and wanting to get exposure to that asset class. And we've been quite vocal in our view that the long-term case for ownership for Japanese equities is pretty favourable, actually. I think for modest risk of ownership in Japan, you can get potentially a kind of a 10-year compound total return of sort of 12% or more, which is not to be sniffed at, again, for modest risk of ownership. So I think that appreciation on the part of global investors has grown. So I think that's probably been a reason why we've seen some inflows. I don't get to see exactly what my competitors do, so I'm not totally sure what we do that's completely different. If I had to, based on the information I have, I do think that our strategy and our approach is a little bit different in the sense that we are kind of factor agnostic. You know, the active management landscape for Japanese equities over the years, it has become quite polarized into I'm a growth manager or I'm an old-fashioned value manager, and I don't mean old-fashioned in a pejorative sense,
sure.
But it's quite polarized, and we don't really occupy either of those positions. We've got a stock picking program that is agnostic as to style. I'm not wedded to one view or the other, actually. We try to find very specific, company-specific debates or controversies in companies that we think we've earned the right to have a differentiated perspective about, where those debates are associated with kind of asymmetric return outcomes.
So does that mean you like to have it sort of a little bit of everything in your fund on that basis?
I think that's, look, in an ideal world, I like to find mispricings in growth stocks, in value stocks, in quality stocks, in restructuring and turnaround stories. In an ideal world, I'd love to have a portfolio that mixes all of those. In reality, we have to play the cards that the market deals us. But we work pretty hard to make sure that the risk in the portfolio and then the ex post returns are driven by so-called esoteric risk and not this factor or that factor. And I think that maybe there's not so many fund managers in Japan specifically with that type of stock picking style agnostic approach.
I wanted to drill down on where exactly these inflows are coming from. Who's buying the fund? Is a significant amount of the cash coming from Prudential?
In terms of the M&G Japan Fund, no. We do manage money on behalf of the Prudential Insurance Company in a different fund. So in terms of our total Japan exposure, that is non-trivial. I think in terms of the inflows into the M&G Japan Fund, it's come from the UK, it's come from Europe. We've got some investors in Israel, so it's been quite broad-based. We also manage money on behalf of some Japanese investors in terms of our Japan exposure.
What would you say that your best calls have been that have enabled you to beat the benchmark over 3 years?
If I look at the contribution to returns in the last 3 years, it's the first thing is that it's quite well spread. So it's not just one thing that's gone right. And that's what we'd expect in terms of how we build the portfolio. So we've been fortunate that we've got a diversified set of investments that have done really well for us. Obviously, some stand out, and I will mention some of those. But before drilling into those, I would like to say that we've actually contributed a lot to relative outperformance of the benchmark by things that we don't own. And that's something that I pay particular attention to.
Could you highlight some examples, though?
I can get myself into trouble.
Yeah.
But so, for example, some of the best companies that in terms of me appreciating their business model and the quality of their moat have been businesses that we haven't owned in recent years. Nidec, for example, is an amazing company in Japan, but we took issue with what we thought, going back 3 years, what we thought were excessive expectations around EV traction motors. And we thought the market was pricing the stock for disappointment, and it's a big part of the index, and we chose strategically to own none of it. That stock has subsequently underperformed very meaningfully and then therefore contributed to our outperformance. So when we're thinking about beating the benchmark over the medium and long term, we are thinking about what do we own and what do we not own. There's two sides of that ledger. So we've had some strategic underweights that have helped us. But then obviously the main driver has been some targeted overweight positions. Our biggest contributor in the last 3 years actually has been a company called Sanrio. I don't know if you know Sanrio. It's the owner of the Hello Kitty brand. And by the way, they've got a diversified portfolio of character IP. They own Mr. Men, for example. But just Hello Kitty alone, since it was created in the 1970s, has outsold Mickey Mouse in terms of merchandise revenue. And obviously, Mickey Mouse was created in the 1920s. So it's incredible latent value in that character IP. The company historically was not run to optimize profit or return on invested capital. 3 years ago, a new CEO came in. We sat down with the CEO, asked for an invitation to be a helpful shareholder, made some proposals. They took them and acted on them, and the company's now generating record profits. The stock's up 600%, and we're still happy owners. Yeah. What's really interesting about that example is it highlights the latent potential that sits in the Japanese equity asset class. I think people get excited about cash-rich balance sheets and share buybacks, and that's all very interesting and will help returns. The big delta that can be generated from an investment perspective, I think, is finding companies that are a shadow of what they could be with two or three tweaks to their commercial strategy.
On the other side of that, you're very underweight Nintendo, which has got a very strong IP there. Yeah. I mean, if we're talking about Hello Kitty, about sort of characters, etc. Why do you like the Hello Kitty owner but not Nintendo?
Well, I love Nintendo as a company, and we've been very meaningful shareholders of the company at various points in the last 20 years. Back in 2005, I think we were the biggest foreign owner at that point in my career. So I definitely have got a huge appreciation for the business. And I think the character potential and value there is enormous. I think we have, at various points in recent years, been owners and non-owners. We have been underweight more recently because I feel like they're not growing their installed base of users. And I think potentially the market's expectations about future growth based on the current strategies that sits today are maybe a bit too elevated. But it's a great company. We've just felt that we could generate maybe better returns in other stocks.
Because it all hinges on the next hardware release, really, at this point.
What'll be interesting in the next hardware release is to see, can they actually grow their installed base? The installed base today is probably 100, 110 million of discrete users. They either need to go open source with their software, which they're committed to not doing currently, or find other ways to monetize their character IP. And they've started movies and things. But some of the survey data we look at suggests that potentially even a new hardware refresh will kind of give a blip to software sales in the short term. But they really need to grow that handheld install base to 150 or 200 million to really move the needle or reassess the strategy.
Has the Japanese market got too hot? We saw all-time highs recently.
Yeah.
What's your approach?
Obviously, I think about it. In the last 15 months or so, the market's up, well, in local currency terms, maybe getting on for 50%, that type of order. It's a big move, and I think it forces the question of, how does valuation look today? So I've got a few thoughts on that. I think that looking back 15 months, the starting point was that valuation was way too low. Right? I think the starting point here was, I wouldn't say distressed valuations, but excessively cheap valuations with respect to growth prospects, quality, reform, capital return, and so on. It was hiding in plain sight, is the phrase we used at the time. So fast forward to today, we've had some good returns from the market. That always worries me, but I don't see euphoria. There's a few pockets of maybe euphoric equity pricing in a few semiconductor stocks. That's kind of isolated to about 6 or 7% of the index, so it's not, we don't have that AI phenomenon.
So it's not like the US.
Yeah, the US could be 50% of the market cap potentially is concentrated around that thematic, that single thematic. We don't have that in Japan. The gains have been broad-based, so that's quite healthy. Headline valuations still look quite reasonable. Within the market, there's a really good, healthy spread of valuations. There's still lots of excessively cheap stocks. So I think I don't see any kind of warning signs that you'd normally associate with a market that's really running hot. But it's had a big move, so it's a fair question. I suspect that the market triples in the next decade, something like that. I think the market is still priced for good double-digit returns, and for long-term patient holders, I think there's a really good opportunity here. I don't know what the market will do in the next month or two, obviously, but yeah. I feel like there is still a lot more upside for the market over the medium to long term. Earnings are growing at a really good clip, and I think that's ultimately what's going to drive the market.
The size of your fund has grown exponentially since you took over. I mean, has that caused the strategy to become capacity constrained in any way? And how are you going to achieve alpha going forward?
Well, it's not capacity constrained. We're the M&G Japan fund is just over 5 billion. our capacity, which we look at from a perspective of the size of ownership we have in companies and then also the trading liquidity, that capacity is way above what we currently manage. You know, and it's a $6 trillion equity market and we run $5 billion. Just sort of common sense would say it's not crazy. So I'm not so much worried about capacity. I think I always worry about generating alpha. Where does the next really good investment idea come from? And the beauty of this game is you just never know. What I find quite interesting about the Japan market is the degree of inefficiency. I mean, people expect inefficiency in smaller cap companies. In Japan, we see quite big inefficiencies, even in the large cap space. So I'm quite confident that when I look at where we've generated returns the last 3 years, a big chunk of it has actually come from the mega caps, which is maybe less, would be less of the case if you look at outperforming managers in the US, for example. So capacity-wise, we have no issues. And I think in terms of idea generation, there's so much change going on in the corporate sector. And markets are not very good at pricing change. So with that backdrop, I feel like the idea pipeline is quite rich, and I expect that to continue.
So $5 billion at the moment, what's the limit?
I think when people talk about capacity, we should realise that it is not a fixed number, right? So we think about it from the perspective of having a range, and that range is well above where we are today. The approach we've taken to capacity measurement and assessment has been consistent since the day I joined at M&G. It's not changed. We've got the same approach. And refreshing that analysis shows we've got really good upside to capacity. And that's good, because I think the opportunity set is rich going forward, and we're excited.
We're drilling down a little bit more. You've got more than a quarter of the fund in small and mid-cap stocks. Mm-hmm. Are you crowding out some of those companies due to the size of the strategy at the moment?
I don't think so. I don't feel that we have positions that I want to get bigger that I can't because of our size. So no. But I do feel that, particularly given the large move in the market, so the move in the market in the last 15 months has been driven by the large caps, actually. And it's quite unusual in my career. When animal spirits kind of pick up, oftentimes investors will kind of move down that market cap spectrum. That hasn't happened yet in Japan. So that's why we're sort of positioned there. So the fact that we're positioned there kind of illustrates I'm finding plenty of elbow room to do it. The initial rush of enthusiasm in the last 15 months in Japan, I think, has played out primarily in these larger, frankly, global investors have been buying the names that they know. So the return to stock picking skill in that moment can be a bit lower. Prospectively, I think that will probably broaden out. That's what tends to happen based on my historic experience.
Yeah. And have there been any challenges deploying capital in the sort of Japan's second exchange?
No, we've had no issues deploying. I mean, as these inflows have happened, we've just pro rata increased the portfolio. The way I think about portfolio risk, frankly, won't change if we're at $1 billion or $5 billion. I run the same portfolio with the same constraints, with the same approach, the same strategy, trying to extract alpha from the same set of opportunities. So far, we've had no issues, yeah.
I wanted to talk about, I think it's your top holding at the moment, Toyota, or it sort of moves between sort of all the sort of top five, depending on performance. Last fact sheet said 6.4% weighting. It's very slightly under the benchmark.
Yeah.
Shares have been up significant amount.
Yeah.
Can they continue to rally? What point do you sell?
Yeah, so we have reduced our weighting a little bit. So we were previously overweight and we've kind of gone to a more neutral position, as you point out. And I think that really reflects the amazing share price move that we've seen. Toyota's been on a bit of a PR journey in the last few years. It was really just over a year ago where the consensus was that it was backsliding on climate issues, that it was against electrification, and there was a little bit of negative sentiment, and we never thought that was justified, actually, and so we had some conversations with the company to encourage them to maybe be a bit more open about disclosing the various technologies that they are leading the world in that will be helpful in when we arrive at the new mobility, whatever that looks like.
That's sort of specific on its solid state battery innovation.
So we've got solid state batteries, we've got Megapress, potentially could meaningfully reduce the cost of manufacturing a car and make them safer. Various technologies in terms of drivetrain as well as software. So there's been lots going on at Toyota. And thankfully they took our advice, and I'm sure we weren't the only ones suggesting it. I don't mean I'm not trying to take credit here, but I think that the shareholders like us have encouraged the company to be more open about what they are doing, because what they're doing is very considerable. So they held a series of technology days and investor days last year in the second half. And I think that that is absolutely associated with why the share price really re-rated. Definitely strong earnings helped, for sure. But the discount around them being behind the eight ball, which was previously the perception of the market, there was a discount that they were behind in electrification. I think the market is now saying, actually, mobility is complicated and we're going to need different technologies. And actually, Toyota, in fact, we now know has got quite a lot of the parts of the jigsaw puzzle.
I suppose there's been a bit of a resurgence of interest in hybrid vehicles.
Definitely. So they're really in a sweet spot from a margin perspective. They've got the lowest unit cost in the world when it comes to hybrids. And you know, what we're seeing in all markets, I should say most markets, definitely in the US, is consumers have slowed down a little bit on full electrified vehicles. And we've seen a preference for hybrid vehicles, and Toyota's in a great position there. So they're continuing to take
market share. Is it too reliant on hybrid vehicles?
I don't think so. We've got a global fleet of 1.5 billion cars. It's not obvious to me that in all cases, in all countries, that they should all be electric. Maybe eventually, when we really fix the global electric grid.
I suppose the infrastructure needs to catch up.
The infrastructure needs to catch up. The battery technology, frankly, probably needs to improve a little bit more as well, both on the safety front and on the energy density side of things. So what's interesting about electrification, if you know, fully electrified vehicles, is if you take a world-leading gasoline or petrol engine, you put 100 units of energy into it, and we're going to talk roughly here, we're going to get, you know, Twitter comments from people more well-informed than I, but roughly 50 units of those 100 are wasted in heat. In a really high-end electric motor, it's about 7 units are wasted in heat. So it's a no-brainer. So the electric engine is much more efficient than the combustion engine. The problem is that gasoline and diesel are really good stores of energy from a density perspective, much better than lithium-ion batteries. So should we have electric motors? Yes, obviously, no-brainer. Batteries, eventually, when they get better. So, you know, we're in this transition phase, and I think we probably were on a slightly over-accelerated path towards full electrification, given where the technology was. That was always Toyota's point. So they said, we're gonna have hydrogen cars, we're gonna have hybrids, we're gonna have fully electrified, and they'll be appropriate depending on where in the world they're used and in what use case. I think they were always honest, but their honesty around this issue in recent years, I think, was abused by some of the certain lobby groups who stood to benefit from, you know, a faster adoption of electrification.
I wanted to look at a holding that you're particularly bullish on, 7&I, which owns 7-Eleven. Why do you like the stock so much? It's perhaps not one that has shot the lights out. So
it hasn't. No, underperformed last year. It was flattish last year. The market was up, you know, high 20, so underperformed. It's having a better run of it this year. I think that this is another one of those cases of quite extreme valuation hiding in plain sight. I believe that 7-Eleven's convenience store business is one of the best retail franchises globally. If I think about over my 25-year career, companies that are commercial killers, 7-Eleven is one of them. I mean, they have killed all of their competition in Japan. They own more than 40% market share of convenience stores in Japan. If you judge that by revenue, it's about 50% of the market. And if you judge it by the net profit pool, it's about 70%. So they really did crush everyone. That domestic business is still growing, but is a lower growth proposition going forward. So the company is expanding globally. Not many companies have, as in not hundreds, there's not that many companies in Japan have successfully globalized in a big way, and 7 is one of them. So they bought Speedway a couple of years ago. So it's now 60% of the business is US. So, So we've got a global business with a global footprint. They've just made a really good acquisition in Australia, where the US market, for example, is heavily fragmented still. The convenience store industry in the US looks like it did in Japan maybe 25 years ago. And 7 is successfully deploying its Japan playbook of seek and destroy everyone else in the US, which is 3 times bigger than the Japan market. So there's a huge structural growth runway to consolidate that industry in the US. They're already the number one, so they are now the buyer of choice. So I think nothing's ever on autopilot, but they've got a brilliant management team and a strong strategy in the convenience store business to deliver several years of strong growth. So the first point is, I think we've got a global growth company here that's really high quality with a great track record. What are people sulking about? Why is it on 12 times cash earnings? You know, when Starbucks would be double that, or their US peers in the convenience store sector would be 80% higher than that. It's because there's some conglomerate stuff going on. So there are some other legacy businesses that investors want to see them get rid of. And investors feel that that change is not happening quickly enough. I have some sympathy for that.
And when you say sort of get rid of it, there've been sort of murmurings of splitting off some of the parts of the
just
business.
Just this week, they've literally announced yesterday. They announced their intention to take. It's a business segment called Superstores, and there's a few different businesses in there. And ultimately, they're giving investors what investors want, which is they're saying we're going to. We recognise there's still some strategic benefit of these businesses working together, but we no longer need to own the business.
Market didn't react very well to it, though, so it's down a couple of percent.
Yeah, stock was down a little bit last night. You know, who knows around short-term positioning around these things? Who knows? I'm really not worried about the one-day move. I think what's interesting is if I just now look forward 1 or 2 years, we're talking about the company having done really everything that investors wanted. I can count on one hand the number of times I've been able to buy a global leading company that's global, right? So more of the business is non-Japanese today than Japanese, and the growth is coming from that. Where compared to global peers, it's at, you know, 50% discount. I think this is a fantastic kind of long-term outperformance, a source of outperformance for the portfolio.
Following on from Seven and I, you're generally quite bullish on consumer discretionary stocks. You've got sort of 5% over the index in that sector. Why do you like it?
A bit of a health warning here. In terms of sector exposure in Japan, I feel like the GICS codes are a little bit random sometimes. So I don't actually feel, from an underlying perspective, like we're particularly overweight consumer discretionary. Some classifications just look a bit weird. So I think the reality is we're not really overweight that sector, even though from a pure metric of GICS codes exposures that would look like it. I think what I can say is that something is interesting on the consumption front in Japan. The country is experiencing wage growth, which is, you know, hasn't really happened in my entire career. And I suspect that the chances that we start reading or even thinking more about autonomous consumption growth, self-reinforcing growth in the Japanese economy coming from wage growth, is those chances are improving. So I am, that's not reflected in the portfolio. We've just got some single stock esoteric risk, but I am minded to be cautious that we could have quite a strong consumption environment in the next couple of years. I'm not counting that out.
You might have a similar sort of response regarding GICS codes, IT as well, you're a bit underweight there. Do you see issues with Japanese tech?
I don't. I think it's in a really interesting spot. I'd say we're probably more neutral on a really true underlying basis, but it's a good question that I think at the moment, the situation in Japanese tech is a little bit polarized. We've got semis and we've got everything else. Okay, so semis have attracted the AI crowd. So I'd say at this point, big leading semi stocks are priced, I don't know about for perfection, but they're priced for very good outcomes.
Could you give some examples that you think are particularly?
Yeah, I think Tokyo Electron is very aggressively priced right now. It's one of my favorite companies. They do a great job. We own it. We're a little bit underweight because I think the valuation's not leaving a lot of scope for any mistakes. Companies like Disco, which we don't own, also one of my favorite companies, but I'd say pretty eye-watering valuations at this point. So I think, you know, this happens when you get new technologies that come along. You know, AI is going to reshape everything that we do. That's not lost on people. We all read the papers. And investors want to get exposure to that. And at the moment, they're kind of crowded in a pretty small space. So coming back to Japanese tech, we've got the semis and we've got everything else. So I'd say I'm not seeing a lot of things in semi space in Japan at the moment that I really want to be overweight of. Certainly anything that's got the AI theme around it. But, you know, in the passive components, there's interesting things where stocks have not performed at all, more for cyclical reasons. Companies like Roam, which has been heavy underperformer, but has got some really interesting structural growth coming over the next 5-10 years from silicon carbide. So there's a lot going on in Japanese tech that I think is interesting. If we have time, I would just highlight that I think NTT is really interesting. So this is, you know, the incumbent telco. It doesn't get a lot of airtime amongst tech investors. But if there's an area that Japan is very well placed to contribute globally, on a global scale, with Reflect that AI halo, it would be in the area of optical semiconductors. And I do think that the current kind of GPU-centric approach to generative AI compute is broken. I think the ARM...
This is the next step, basically.
This is the next step. I think if we want to... The ARM CEO tweeted recently that at current trends, more than 20% of US energy consumption will be feeding, you know, hyperscalers by 2030. So that we've got to fix that.
Yeah.
There's a big technology race going on around the world to fix that. My sense, and I'll be wrong because I can't forecast the future, but my sense is there's a good chance that the best shot on goal for the world achieving much, much lower density, energy density per unit of compute will come in optical semiconductors. And Japan's got leadership position there. And specifically NTT, I think has got one of the world's biggest IP portfolios and is specifically focused on this issue. It's been working on this since 2019. So there are definitely pockets of really interesting things in technology in Japan. We're less kind of exposed to the semi area right now. I mean, we're not massively underweight because this is a freight train, and I'm not in the business of trying to dodge trains. But I think we're looking for areas where maybe the market's not yet quite appreciated the technology value proposition.
Healthcare is another area that seemingly you're quite underweight in.
We are underweight,
in the portfolio.
Yeah.
Concerns there?
No concerns. I think it just honestly reflects we have less ideas in that space currently. You know, our investment approach is very much based on, as I said earlier, just trying to find very company-specific debates that we think have got asymmetric returns associated with them.
So perhaps the level of innovation in the Japanese market is maybe not as high as you'd like?
I wouldn't even say that. I would just say there may be some out there, but we currently do not observe any big grisly debates in Japanese healthcare stocks where we feel we've earned the right to a differentiated perspective. And so we've got calls for capital elsewhere. So it's all the net result of that is that we are a bit underweight the sector. I don't really have a top-down view about that innovation. I mean, actually, on the innovation front, you know, Japan is Japan's leading on cell and gene therapy discoveries. So I don't have a particular concern on the innovation point. I would just say we don't have good ideas in that space right now. That's the honest truth.
We've talked about some of your relative underweight positions and maybe not super concerned about them. It's just the sort of structure of your portfolio. But is there an area that you are quite concerned about?
Well, I mentioned semis. You know, I think that I'm concerned about it because I think the valuations tell me I should be more underweight than I am. But I'm trying to be pragmatic that something very big is happening in the world. And I don't want... So small underweights in stocks that are moving 100% every 6 months can do real damage.
Sure.
So I feel that my small underweight actually is behaving like it's not so small. So I'm trying to be careful about portfolio construction. I don't want my performance to be about any one thing. I don't want to have to go to my investors in a year and say, sorry, we got run over by AI. That's not, or by growth or value or any other factor. So, I'm a bit worried about the valuations in semis. I totally get the excitement of the market and fundamentally I completely agree with it. But how that's reflected in valuations has become, you know, a bit concerning. That doesn't worry me for the market overall, as we said earlier. I was just calculating this week, it's 7.2% of the MSCI Japan, I think, is kind of exposed to that. So it's not a systemic issue for the market, but I'm a bit wary of that.
What have you been adding and cutting from the portfolio recently?
There's a few things we've been doing. We've not been super busy. We've added a couple of names that have got exposures in the robotics industry. And we're doing a lot of work here. I think it is, again, we're going to come back to AI, I'm sorry. So we're at the point now where interest in AI is quite concentrated in the sort of the first ripple as the stone goes into the pond, which is semiconductors. That's the bottleneck. Okay. As that ripples out, it's going to start impacting the economy and different parts of industries in myriad different ways. So the robotics industry is about $40, $50 billion a year. It's been growing about 20% clip for a long time. It's been a growth industry. People got really excited about it 5 or 7 years ago. So it's not a news story, but that existing hardware technology now can, I think, go through a period of turbocharged growth because robots can now have brains. So if you think about what robots do today, they're in factories mostly, doing very highly repetitive tasks really well. They're not mobile. and they can't cope with variability in the environment. Transformer technology, large language models, completely changing that. And you've seen a bunch of stuff on, you know, social media recently about these amazing things that humanoid robots are on the verge of being able to do. If we look out 10 years and listen to, you know, Masayoshi Son, or if we listen to Elon Musk, they're talking about a market for humanoid robots of 200 million. If you say there's a $20,000 unit price, that's the global auto industry today in revenue terms. It's massive. So I don't know what the future looks like in 10 years' time, and Elon Musk says all sorts of things, so let's not get too carried away. But I think bringing it back to where we are today, the market is paying extraordinary valuations for the semiconductors, and the next ripple to me would be robotics, which is we can now put brains in this existing hardware, massively expanding the value added that they can perform for the economy. And there'll be all sorts of ethical and social issues, which are all complicated, of course. But so I think that, again, thinking about Japan, there's actually a lot of beneficiaries of that in Japan. And importantly for me, the stock's really not pricing any of that in. So back to your question of where we've been active, we have added some exposure on the robotic side, and we're doing a lot more work there. I think that's an area where Japan's got the right to win.
And cutting?
You know, we've taken some profits. We bought
Toyota specifically, I suppose.
Yeah, we have trimmed it. We still own it, but we're more neutral versus the benchmark. We exited, let me think, Rakuten Bank, which was a really strong performer. We backed the IPO of that company last year, so it wasn't the stock performed so well that actually we ended up exiting it in the first quarter of this year. Very unluckily for them, they IPO'd during the Silicon Valley Bank issue last year, so there were no buyers. So we were able to deploy a good amount of capital at what I thought was the wrong price, you know, and the stock doubled and more. So we exited, we just took profits. Business is doing absolutely fine, there's no issues, but it really performed, frankly, a bit better than we thought it would, and in terms of the share price, more quickly, certainly. So we exited that, and we've redeployed it. But no wholesale kind of readjustments in the portfolio. Yeah.
I want us to look at Japanese government reforms. They've been sort of getting a lot of airtime recently.
Yeah.
How important are they?
I think they're really important, actually. I think they're really important. And I think that they have been important for, well, I mentioned earlier that Japanese earnings have been compounding at sort of 10% clip for a while. I think that would not have happened if it wasn't for government policy. You know, that goes back to Abenomics 2012, 13, 14. So I think that it's hard for me to overestimate how important it's been. The Japanese government came along and said, we're going to change the way that we allocate resources in the economy. It's really big and it takes a long time. It has taken 10 years to get where we are today, which is that Japanese companies now have, I'd say, really the full complement of tools. There's always improvements. We could tweak the Companies Act here or there, tax code here or there. But ultimately, we've got a governance code, we've got a stewardship code, we've got fair M&A rules, we've got proper proxy voting. None of this existed 10 years ago.
And how much of that do you think has fueled markets recently?
Well, I think markets are slow to overreact, you know, so markets ignored it and then they've caught up to what's been happening in the last 18 months. People know this. The long-term implications of it are pretty powerful.
I suppose the counter to that is that tail can't last forever. There's probably a few years of impact and then...
That's true. I mean, nothing lasts forever. I'd say what's exciting to me about the opportunity is that there's still so much low-hanging fruit in Japan. What can't last forever is the... if you've got excess cash in your balance sheet, or your working capital is a bit lazy, or you could sell your headquarters for a small fortune and do a share buyback, those are kind of one-time sugar hits. The bit that I think people underestimate, and we're seeing this with Sanrio, for example, is if you have really good IP and you change the way you monetize that IP, intellectual property, if you've got good products, and you change your go-to-market strategy, you change your pricing strategy, you change your R&D strategy, you stop making 1,400 things and make 50 really well. The second and third order effects of that become really powerful, and we are seeing that happening. So Hitachi is a great point, which is people said 5 years ago, the story's over. But it's not, because actually, by the time you actually become number one or number two globally in your space, which is just where, you know, 7-Eleven's kind of brinking on, the second and third order effects come in. So your return on invested capital goes 4 to 7 and people say it's over, and then they go to 25. So I think that it's the Jim Collins flywheel effect. We definitely are going to have a one-time hit of capital redeployment. For me, the long-term success is very rapid improvement. Sorry, very big, I would say, more than rapid. Big improvement in margins. And then companies that become more competitive and end up growing revenues more. I think the impact of that is really big.
What about the Japanese version of the ISA? There's been sort of innovations there. The NISA. It seems to have a sort of exactly the same naming convention, which is interesting. Yeah. I mean, has that had much impact in pushing Japanese markets?
I don't think so, actually, not yet. I think it's a really good idea. Japanese are chronically underinvested in their own stock market. And it's not like they're getting any yield anywhere else domestically. And Kishida has pointed this out. You know, he's been quite vocal that Japanese should be more invested in their own stock market.
Quite a similar story to the UK then on that
yeah,
basis.
Yeah. And, you know, so what he's done as of Jan 1st this year was to triple the size of the tax-free savings accounts that can go into stock markets and mutual funds. That allocation has been taken up, so people are doing it. So I think we've only got data for January and February. It's around about 1.6 trillion yen has gone into these accounts in those 2 months. So it's not huge. Mm. It's incremental, but that's fine. I think that's how we don't need, and we should not expect, and we do not need a kind of wall of money coming into the market. It's not going to help anyone.
Sure.
It just disrupts prices and people get bad outcomes. I think it's a thoughtful plan, which is my understanding of the plan, is that over time those limits will continue to rise and will gradually, through sort of dollar cost averaging, get Japanese households more invested in their own equity market. We do need to repair equity culture, if we were to call it something, in Japan. And I think this is a sensible approach. And I'm really pleased to see that people are taking advantage of that new increase in that allotment. But the numbers are incremental. There was a bit of expectation in January that there might be a big gold rush. I think that was always probably a little bit unrealistic. But in terms of, I think the implications here will play out over the longer period of time, which is that you'll get more participation in the stock market, which is good.
Well, Carl, thanks so much for joining me today.
Yeah, a pleasure. Thank you.